From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, murdered Israeli teens mourn. Self-proclaimed caliph orders Muslims to move to the new Islamic State. Japan's defense, plus mixed opinions about World Cup impact on Brazil's economy. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Israel is retaliating for the murder of three Jewish teenagers in the West Bank, allegedly by Palestinian militants. Robert Berger reports from the VOA Bureau in Jerusalem.
There was panic in the Gaza Strip as Israeli aircraft bombed more than 30 targets, most of them linked to the Palestinian militant group Hamas. The airstrikes came hours after Israel blamed Hamas for the murder of three kidnapped teenagers and vowed that the group would pay a heavy price. The bodies of the Jewish seminary students were found in a field near the biblical town of Hebron in the West Bank, where thousands of Israeli troops are continuing to search for the two alleged Hamas kidnappers. The abduction and murders are putting pressure on Western-backed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, a month after he angered Israel by forming a unity government with Hamas. Israel, the United States, the European Union, and even Egypt consider Hamas a terrorist organization. Israeli spokesman Mark Regev.
President Abbas must now immediately annul his pact with Hamas. If the Palestinian leadership says that it's opposed to terrorism, they cannot be in a political alliance with the murderers of children.
Hamas has neither confirmed nor denied responsibility, so Mr. Abbas has said that Israel must provide proof. But the Palestinian president said whoever is responsible must be condemned. Palestinian official Abdullah Abdullah.
A loss of lives, whether Israeli or Palestinian, we regret that and we feel sorry for that.
Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri said the group does not want an escalating cycle of violence. But he said if Israel launches a war on Gaza, Hamas is prepared to defend the Palestinian people. As Israel considered further retaliatory measures against Hamas, the nation observed a day of mourning.
Adonai Natan. Adonai Lakach.
There were somber prayers and processions at West Bank settlements as the three Israeli teenagers were laid to rest. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Leader of the extremist group that has swept over much of northern Syria and Iraq called on Muslims Tuesday to emigrate to the territory his group has seized to help build an Islamic State. A 19-minute audio tape from Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi came 2 days after his organization, the Islamic State of the Iraq and the Levant, sometimes referred to as ISIL or ISIS, unilaterally declared the establishment of an Islamic State or caliphate in the land it controls. It also proclaimed al-Baghdadi as head of the state and demanded that all Muslims around the world pledge allegiance to him. In his first remarks since the bold declaration, al-Baghdadi urged Muslims to come build their caliphate. He made a special appeal to those with practical skills, such as scholars, judges, doctors, engineers, and people with military and administrative expertise, to come, in his words, answer the dire need for Muslims for them. He also called on jihadi fighters to escalate fighting in the holy month of Ramadan, which began on Sunday. The audio was posted on militant websites where the group has issued statements in the past, and the voice resembled that on other audio tapes, said to be al-Baghdadi, an Iraqi militant who has rarely been photographed or even appeared in public. Al-Baghdadi has a $10 million U.S. bounty on his head from the United States. Syria's opposition has called on the international community to help it combat the work of the Sunni militants who have taken over portions of Syria as well as Iraq. Haleg Saleh is a spokesperson for the Syrian National Coalition. He says the SNC is not pleased with al-Baghdadi's declaration of an Islamic State.
The Syrian coalition strongly condemns the declaration by ISIS. We believe the only aim from such declaration is to undermine the revolution. We have to remind everybody that the only group that faced ISIS until now is the FSA. The FSA fought against ISIS in Idlib and Aleppo. The FSA, as we speak right now, is fighting against ISIS in Deir ez-Zor, the oil-rich province in Syria. And ISIS continue to kill civilians day after day, not only in the areas that they control, but in the areas they attempt to control.
The FSA, the Free Syrian Army, has not been able to counter the Sunni militants and needs help to make sure the insurgency is not successful in creating the Islamic State.
We've always told the international community that the policy of containment is a failed policy. ISIS will continue to grow. The FSA, with its very limited weapons, are having to face ISIS, which captured also some weapons from Iraq, continues to have the largest amount of money at their hands, so they continue to grow. Unfortunately, it means that we have to continue to fight this uphill battle. It is really, at this point, the ball is in the international community's court. They need to act. They need to arm the FSA.
That is Khalid Saleh, a spokesperson for the Syrian National Coalition. Kurdish forces are rushing to fortify their front lines against ISIL fighters, creating a border that could eventually define a possible future Kurdish state in northern Iraq, as Islamic extremists seek to sweep away borders in their advance across the Middle East. Kurds in northern Iraq are in the process of establishing a new one, asserting their claim to disputed territory and expanding their semi-autonomous region in a bid for greater autonomy or outright independence. Deputy head of the Kirkuk Provincial Council, Rebwar Talabani, said Tuesday that although nothing has yet been built, a border has already been defined. He said that if Shiite and Sunni forces don't abide by a pact to draw the borders of Iraq and Kurdistan, then the Kurdish province would have the right to take areas that it lost before 2003. Concrete blocks in a small hut topped with a green and white red Kurdish flag blocked the bridge that was near the city of Mariam Bek. That happened on Tuesday. That village lies about 80 kilometers from Tikrit, which is now held by ISIL. And just up the road, the Islamic State has its own dirt barriers marking where its territory begins.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Ukraine has relaunched a military offensive against pro-Russia rebels in the east of the country after a ceasefire failed to take hold. Russia's President Vladimir Putin accused his Ukrainian counterpart of seeking war, while some regional analysts are saying Moscow is the one fueling the conflict. We get more now from VOA's Daniel Scharf.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko on Tuesday ended a week-long unilateral ceasefire, noting it was not being honored by pro-Russia separatists in the east. Despite the ceasefire, rebels continued deadly attacks against Ukrainian military. Civilians and journalists, including a Russian cameraman, were also killed in recent fighting. In a speech, Mr. Poroshenko declared an all-out offensive against the separatists.
Ми будемо наступати.
He says they will attack and free their land. The non-extension of the ceasefire plan is the response to terrorists, rebels, and marauders, he says, and to all those who torture civilians, who paralyze the country's economy, who wreck payments of salaries, pensions, and studentships, who explode railway stations and destroy water pipes, and who deprive people of a normal, peaceful life. Western and Russian leaders had urged dialogue in hopes of extending the ceasefire. The Ukraine leader talked with Russian President Vladimir Putin, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and French President François Hollande before deciding on military action. President Putin called the Ukrainian leader's decision regrettable. He characterized talks with President Poroshenko as one-sided ultimatums and compared the situation in Ukraine to instability in Iraq, Libya, and Syria that is threatening to spread.
Unfortunately, President Poroshenko
Mr. Putin says, unfortunately, President Poroshenko took the decision to restart military operations. He says he and his European colleagues could not convince the Ukrainian president that the road to stable, strong, and long-lasting peace does not lie through war. Mr. Poroshenko describes the Russian president's recent withdrawal of a declared right to use military force in Ukraine as a symbolic gesture. But he says Moscow has not taken concrete steps to de-escalate the situation and strengthen control over the border. Kiev and many Western capitals point to the rebels' advanced weapons as clear evidence the Kremlin is sending arms across the border. Pavel Felgenauer is a defense analyst and columnist with Novaya Gazeta newspaper in Moscow. He says supplying separatists is part of the Kremlin's strategy to maintain leverage with the Western-leaning government in Kiev.
So Moscow, though wanting a freeze of the present situation, more or less as it is, and Moscow not wanting the separatists to be militarily defeated, is supplying arms, not in an attempt for the kind of help the rebels to march on Kyiv, which is hardly possible, but to uphold some kind of military balance on the ground.
Felgenauer says the rebels are the only ones who do not support a ceasefire.
They hope that if they provoke more fighting and if the Ukrainian military will begin to grind them up and there will be high civilian casualties as a result, this will force Moscow's hand and Moscow would intervene militarily.
The rebels, mostly ethnic Russians, want independence from the Western-leaning government in Kiev and closer ties to Russia. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
While the separatist crisis continues in two small regions of eastern Ukraine, rest of the country trying to return to business as usual, including the port and resort city of Odessa, that's in the south. VOA's Al Pessin reports on the impact in Odessa from the revolution and what's happened since.
As the summer tourist season gets underway, Odessa's main pedestrianized street of shops, bars, and cafes is largely empty. Just as few Ukrainians are venturing into occupied Crimea for their summer vacations, many Russians have been scared away from taking their holidays in Odessa. The Russian media portrays Ukraine's revolution as fascist and focuses on violent incidents like what happened here at Odessa's trade union building in May. Dozens of pro-Russian activists died after firebombs flew in both directions during a clash with anti-Russian protesters. The exact circumstances are still under investigation. During the unrest, some of these tables and chairs were used to build street barricades for anti-Russian protesters. Now, cafe owner Vladislav Bas misses his former Russian customers.
The main problem is Russian tourists. Now, unfortunately, they probably won't want to come to Odessa because of Russian propaganda. But they should understand that we love them. It's just governments that have a conflict. Visitors can come. Nothing bad will happen to Russians here.
Odessa offers sun and sea to visitors, and the sea is also the city's gateway to the world. Its deep-water port on the Black Sea has easy access to Russia, Turkey, and the Mediterranean, and billions of dollars of goods flow through here, moving in all directions. The crisis has made investors and other business executives nervous, but Odessa will bounce back quickly, says Sergei Sinyatinsky of the city's Employers Association.
Odessa is a city with its own vector of development. You can't say that all these events changed anything fundamentally. Odessa has been integrated into the world economy for a long time. Naturally, we had lots of connections to Russia, but they were not key connections.
Still, Odessa needs more tourists, and officials recently appealed to Ukrainians to visit to help fill the void left by the missing Russian tourists. The city is promoting hospitality, good food, and a cosmopolitan, easygoing lifestyle, says Vice Governor Zoya Kazanji.
Odessa is well known. It's a city brand. Anyone who comes here wants to return. We have a proverb: you have one life, so spend it in Odessa.
Instability is never good for business or tourism. So in Odessa, people seem eager to get past the conflict and return to business and life as usual. Al Pessin, VOA News, Odessa.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Japanese lawmakers Tuesday took a historic step away from the country's pacifist constitution and approved the right to collective self-defense or the ability to come to the aid of a friendly country, a move that pleases Washington and angers Beijing. China, which is involved in a territorial dispute with Japan, says Tokyo is challenging the post-war order and raising regional tensions. The move is also opposed by some in South Korea, which along with China was a major victim of Japanese colonial aggression. Japan has been operating under a U.S.-drafted post-war constitution that includes something called Article 9, which renounces war and the threat and use of force to settle disputes and states that land, sea, and air forces, along with war potential, will never be maintained. Jeffrey Hornig, associate professor at the Hawaii-based Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the specifics of the revised security policy have yet to be spelled out in legislation and expects some limitations. He says the United States welcomes the announcement, having long advocated a more proactive Japanese security presence. Hornig does not believe this move guts Article 9.
I don't believe it does. You still have a lot of restrictions. The thing about when Japanese policies change, they usually put a lot of restrictions in place afterwards. It is a change. Article 9 is still in place. It still has a policy of defensive defense, what's called senshu boe in Japanese. That has not changed. I think this is a change, yes, but it's not gutting Article 9.
Are you surprised it took 70 years after the end of the Second World War for Japan to make this move?
I'm not surprised. Actually, until the end of the Cold War, this was really a non-issue. Yes, you had talk about it, but as long as the Cold War was in place and the U.S. was the main defender of Japan, this was really a non-starter in terms of change. But in the past 20 years, when you see a rising China, you see a more active North Korea, and you see questions about U.S. presence, its deployment changing out of Okinawa, when all these things start happening together, then you have a situation where the argument that Japan should do more for its own defense or that Japan should actually provide more for its allies started actually gaining traction. But the fact that it took 20 years to go from the end of the Cold War up until the change that we see happening, that's natural. It took a long time given that the policy that was in place before then was so well entrenched.
Well, there's still a public opposition to this move. There were some protests in front of the Prime Minister's office on Monday. Do you expect the Japanese public to go along?
I expect to see more protests. When you look at public opinion polls of all the major newspapers and media agencies in Japan, they are split. The more left-leaning newspapers or liberal newspapers are opposed. The more conservative newspapers approve. I expect to see more of these oppositions as we get into the fall when the legislation starts getting written and submitted to the parliament.
Does this change mean a larger Japanese defense force?
That, I think, is still unclear. Definitely, it's a different posture for the Japanese defense force. And right now, the U.S. and Japan are working on their defense guidelines that will delineate the roles and missions of each of their forces. But in terms of whether the Japanese armed forces themselves will expand, my own personal opinion is I don't think so, but that's primarily from budgetary pressures.
Hornig says he expects Japan to confine most of its security operations to the Asia-Pacific region. However, in the event of a war in the Middle East that impacts vital oil supplies, he could see Japan participate in international operation using assets like naval minesweepers. Hornig says Japan's military is small compared to China's People's Liberation Armed Forces. However, he cites a recent Carnegie Endowment study showing Japan currently maintains a qualitative edge over Chinese forces, although China continues to modernize its military branches. Also in the news, a car bomb exploded at a market in Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria Tuesday, leaving at least 8 people dead. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the Islamist militant group Boko Haram has repeatedly attacked Maiduguri and other areas in Nigeria. On Sunday, suspected Islamist militants killed more than 50 people in 4 villages about 125 kilometers from Maiduguri. Those attacks took place in the same area where Boko Haram militants kidnapped 270 schoolgirls in April.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and 2 advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays on the Voice of America.
As fans are enjoying football's World Cup, Brazilian authorities are expressing pleasure over the boost they say the tournament is giving the country's economy. However, independent analysts who study such mega events are less enthusiastic. We get the story now from VOA's Scott Bobb in Rio de Janeiro.
The 2014 World Cup has injected an estimated $15 billion into the Brazilian economy and created many jobs. This, according to the head of the government's Embratur Tourism Board, Vicente Neto.
Regarding the human legacy, the numbers are extraordinary. The creation of 1 million jobs in the country due to this great event, 1 million jobs, or 15% of all the jobs created this year in Brazil.
The government has invested $11 billion in stadiums and infrastructure and another $2 billion in security. It is expected to spend billions more preparing for the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio. But an analyst who studies such mega events, architecture and urbanism professor at Rio de Janeiro's Fluminense Federal University, Chris Gaffney, believes these figures are exaggerated.
I don't think that they've invested enough money to create those kind of permanent jobs. I mean, this, in the scale of the Brazilian economy, we're not looking at actually that much money being invested. So it's $30 billion in a $1 trillion economy.
Another expert, Lisa Delpinerotti of George Washington University in the United States, says the real economic benefits of such events are less tangible and more long-term.
There's a lot of transfer of knowledge, so people are learning more about hospitality. There's also the broadcast center where they're being trained in how to use technology. And so I think it's in the media sector, a lot in the hospitality industry, and also in licensing and merchandising, retail.
Chris Gaffney believes the money being spent benefits very few Brazilians.
The World Cup and Olympics are part of an extractive business model that moves around the world very freely, and a top-down business model that uses the interests of local political and economic elites to make money for international corporations.
Delpinerotti disagrees.
Yes, there's been a lot of money spent here, but we have to realize that the infrastructure that they've built up around the World Cup is something that will last and stays in the country.
Other analysts say the Cup may help the Brazilian economy, but it also boosts inflation and public debt. Less than half of the Brazilians in a recent poll believed that hosting the Cup was a good idea. And there have been many demonstrations against the Cup, though they have declined since the tournament began. Nevertheless, many Brazilians are proud to host the World Cup and the 600,000 foreign visitors it brings. They hope that they will spread the good word about Brazil when they return home. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
I kind of cheering you just heard in Scott's piece. Well, let me tell you, there was some of that on Tuesday. Football action went like this. Argentina reaching the quarterfinals with a 1-0 extra time victory over Switzerland in Sao Paulo. In the second round, the final second round on Tuesday, United States and Belgium took to the pitch. Well, that was an extra time game as well. Belgium coming out on top 2-1. Quarterfinals got underway on Friday the 4th and the semifinals on July the 8th. All in all, 64 matches will have been played by the time the final match takes place on July the 13th. And a reminder, you can follow all the World Cup action on Twitter at VOA Football and on the internet at voafootball.com. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Sidrak Franklin, and Zahrat Abu Zed, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. You guys have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On July 2nd, 1897, Italian Guglielmo Marconi obtained a British patent for a new invention, the radio. On July 2nd, 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law an historic Civil Rights Act, removing important legal barriers that had denied equality to black Americans in such areas as education and the use of public facilities.
We can understand without rancor or hatred how this all happened, but it cannot continue. Our Constitution, the foundation of our republic, forbids it.
The 1964 Civil Rights Act intended to end discrimination based on race, color, religion, or national origin. English scholar Thomas Cranmer was born on this day in 1489. It was Cranmer who suggested to King Henry VIII that he didn't need the Pope's permission to divorce his wife so that he, Henry, could marry Anne Boleyn. He then encouraged England's break from Rome, which led to the formation of the Church of England. And on this day in 1947, some believe an object from another world crashed near Roswell, New Mexico. The U.S. Army Air Force insisted, though, it was a weather balloon. And on this day in 1983, the British rock group The Police saw their fifth and most popular album, Synchronicity, at the top of the pop charts. The album included perhaps their best-known single. Every Breath You Take took the Grammy for Best Song of the Year, and Synchronicity spent 17 weeks at number one on the U.S. album chart. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History. Every word you say.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To all who say that sexual abuse is something so ingrained in wars that it can't be eradicated, make no mistake, we can end sexual warfare conducted against innocent people, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said recently in London at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. We can establish new norms that respect women, girls, men, and boys, and we can hold those who commit these acts and those who condone them. We can hold them all accountable. Sexual violence is as old as conflict itself. For thousands of years, marauding armies have felt entitled to rape, pillage, and plunder. So why now, Secretary Kerry asked? Because thousands of years after rape had been written into the lexicon of warfare, we know that it is time to write it out and to banish sexual violence to the dark ages and the history books where it belongs. Sexual assaults have raged in wars of recent times from Darfur to Goma to Srebrenica. So what do we need to do? Secretary Kerry asked. We need a zero-tolerance policy towards sexual violence against women and men. We need to guarantee, country for country, that we can bring the perpetrators to justice. We need to restore dignity to survivors. And, he stressed, we are committed to making sure that women have a seat at the table in resolving conflicts. When people ask whether or not we can actually outlaw sexual violence in warfare, let me tell you the answer is a resounding yes. Yes, we can achieve this goal, he emphasized. Together with all the people here, men and women, boys and girls, who refuse to remain victims, we rise, Secretary Kerry said in conclusion. We rise. We will go out of here and do the work to end this scourge of sexual violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.